Hello everyone, I'm talking to you from the F2 paddock here in Sochi. This is our first podcast back since the tragic events in Belgium. Antoine Hubert was a champion driver. He won the Formula 4 and GP3 titles. But last year, there was a bit of a stress. Antoine's place in motorsport was earned, not bought. And this season, there was something genuinely joyous about him. He was unbound. As the wins in Monaco and France proved, this was a driver unleashed and able to revel in racing on the Grand Prix weekend in Formula 2. As a person, he was engaging and full of empathy. He had a way of putting people at ease. You always sensed a wiseness beyond his years. If you haven't already, I'd encourage you to scroll back through and find the man in his own words with the episode we recorded with him earlier in the year. I said the day after the crash that the highs of our sport are delirious and the lows are levelling. In the weeks which followed, the memory of a brilliant racing driver and man has shone brightly through. He was on a path to the very top. He knew it, and on that path, he made his team, friends, and family immensely proud. We continue to send our prayers and condolences to those close to him. Antoine was special on and off the track, and he will never be forgotten. And just to show you that, a moment ago I passed a photographer who was taking a few shots of six bright pink crash helmets. Antoine's crash helmet, his racing colours, and those will be worn all weekend here in Sochi by his fellow Renault Academy drivers in Formula 3 and Formula 2. Everyone here, in their own way, that's the most obvious, but everyone here in their own way is choosing to remember Antoine, to pay tribute, and as I said in Monza, honouring him by choosing to race. You're listening to F2, The Road to F1. Today, we're going to speak to Callum Ilott, who's a close friend of Antoine, and the teammate to Juan Manuel Correa, who was also seriously injured in that accident. We wish JM all the best in his what will be intensive recovery. Now, I'll level with you. We recorded an interview with Callum earlier in the year at Silverstone. You're going to hear some of that today, and it's him talking about his own racing career. But in that interview, there were references to Antoine, references to Juan Manuel. And so we start today with Callum and a few reflections on an incredibly difficult month. So Callum, we've spoken before we started recording this about discussing everything in detail. Incredibly difficult circumstances. Antoine was a really close friend. JM is your teammate. How are you holding up?
It's never easy in these circumstances. We have gone through Monza. We've done a good month now, I think, since it happened. From everyone's point of view, it's never easy. Monza was a difficult situation for everyone. Turning up there and seeing some empty spaces, one permanently, you know, it's horrible for everyone. But obviously, after going to Monza, and I think for everyone, it was kind of good to, you know, get back in the car. Maybe it was a bit too early, but you know, you can't do anything about the schedule. But to get back in the car, I think it's kind of a relief in some ways, and you know, something that everyone needed to overcome. At least I felt that way. But yeah, I think, you know, from my side, as negative as the whole circumstances were, I use that as a positive to go into Monza, and we'll try and make it as positive as possible. And come away with a pole and almost two good results until the last lap. But you know, it was a good effort from me. But yeah, obviously, I think from everyone's side, it was not easy at all.
We've heard a lot about Antoine the driver. What can you tell us about Antoine the person?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where to start on that one. To be fair, it's hard because I met him at the end of 2015 properly, when we became teammates for 2016 in Formula 3, and then again in 2018, last year, with GP3. And you know, the funny thing is, obviously, you're all competitors, even if you're in the team or not. But, you know, last year we built up a good relationship, especially me and Jake and him. You know, and that's from all the little things when you're traveling to the track together, you're waiting in the car park for someone else to get the car or something like that. And, yeah, he was a really, really good guy, really positive, amazing person, amazing family. And I think it showed in his results, because he was always up there, you know, made it a very difficult time for me and Nikita last year. And he came out the better of us. But yeah, he was very, very hardworking, very dedicated. But yeah, no problems, you know, like no cockiness, nothing like that. I mean, sometimes he knew that he was good, that's for sure. And you could tell, but it was his strength. And I think as a person, he was easy to talk to, easy to have conversations with. Some things he kept to himself, some things he was open about, but that's how everyone can be. But yeah, I mean, such a nice guy and such an easygoing person that I think, you know, would have spent many years in racing, and I think a lot of people would have really loved. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have known him so well, and got to know him. And yeah, it's obviously a sad thing, because he would have been a competitor for a long time in this sport, which I would have been racing against and having some good times with for many, many years to come.
You've also watched, back in Belgium, your teammate suffer injuries in the same accident. I thought it was a lovely sign of respect that your team built up JM's car in Monza. I thought that was a real show of defiance.
Yeah. It was obviously something the team decided to do, and would take a bit of time. It was not easy for them to do it. And actually, this is one of the things that people kind of underestimate. It's not just the drivers who are affected. Obviously, the teams, you know, we had half of our team actually worked with Antoine previously, back with me in Formula 3 in 2016. And work closely, you know, people forget that everyone is impacted by this. I had you know, people who haven't ever raced against him or JM, but you know, because you're in the racing environment, because you're in a paddock, you know, you all feel part of it, and an emotion towards it. So for them to be able to do that, and like when it happened, obviously, you know, the drivers were, well, I know for me that I was upset, for sure. You can't not be. But the teams, all the members of the team show the same level of emotion and that towards it. It's not just the drivers, and it's kind of nice as a community that we all came together. But I think, you know, the teams and that to also come to Monza and be professional and not make any mistakes. I mean, that's the same as us. It shows a real level of, you know, maturity in a way, I guess. And maybe maturity is the wrong word, but yeah, I was really impressed with all of that. But going back to JM, obviously, yeah, you know, being a teammate with someone, you build up a relationship and sort of a common ground, an idea of working together. And then, you know, for you never expect these things to happen, and obviously, yeah, it's a shame. I miss him. You know, we had some good fun this year, but obviously he's got a big battle to fight now. Obviously, I won't comment on, you know, he's got his right to privacy and that. But you know, he's got a big battle to face, and we'll be looking to get back to racing probably as soon as he can. But you know, there's steps before that he's got to take.
When it goes wrong, you're reminded our sport is no game. Did you ever question getting back in the car?
I think we all did. But you know, the thing is, when you're there in the car, it was the same thing actually in Macau at the end of the year last year, because we were in a red flag situation where we had no idea what was going on. And we saw a video of the crash, and obviously, you know, it didn't look good at all. And in a weird way, you know, we all got back in the car. Obviously, we knew Sophia had been taken to hospital, but and she was okay to an extent. But we all got back in the car, and, you know, I got out of the car, and I was like, really, I didn't think about it. Obviously, with Spa, it was a completely different circumstance. There was a different end result, a completely different environment. You weren't back in a car afterwards, so there was a lot of time to reflect and to think about it. I think the thing for me is it highlights, obviously, you know, in this sport, it can go wrong. We hope that it never, ever does, and, you know, I think it's you always hope that you can stay out of like circumstances like that, but you know that there's a chance for it to happen. But this was what Monza was kind of good for, to you know, get back in the car and take your mind off of what had happened. Yes, it was a bit close to all the events, but you know, if I didn't do that, or if you didn't race, that's another week that you'd be thinking about it. But I think at the end of the day, we all in our mind, back of our minds, know the risks. And like I said, you hope that it never does, but these things are a risk that we all sign a contract for and, you know, take. As sad as it is, it's the way it goes.
You mentioned Monza. I thought it was a remarkable response from you, given how you are personally affected by what has happened. A first pole and in contention throughout the races. You must have been very, very pleased with your response to it and your performance until you say maybe the final laps.
You know, the funny thing was, obviously I was very pleased with the pole, or as pleased as I could be in the situation, and quite weirdly, I'm not too emotional sometimes, but in a race car, but that was one time where I was like, you know, you've done a very good job here in mixed conditions and that, to come away with that. But with the races, actually it was quite funny because, you know, the fourth, I dropped off a bit at the end, but that was my best feature race result. But, you know, we came in and we were all pissed off.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know.
I think given what you're talking about, Callum, yeah, we can tolerate that.
No, I mean, me and my engineer, we were just, you know, sat there going like, why were we so slow in the end? You know, we need to figure this out because it wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
But it's my best result, you know. Okay, given where I started, you would hope that you do well, but the feature races are always tough. But yeah, that was the thoughts coming away from that. And then obviously in race two, I was pushing hard, and in the last lap I made a mistake. But you know, up until that last lap, I made no mistake. So to have a weekend like that was something pretty impressive after those events, I guess.
Certainly was an extraordinary response. I think you've spoken some extraordinary words there that will not only give everyone an insight, but give a great many people a comfort as well. Thank you very much for speaking about what was a very difficult couple of weeks for you. We're now going to turn the focus back to your racing career. This is, with wheel guns going off in the paddock, just to let you know that we really do record it in the paddock. This is F2, the road to F1. And it's now time to hear a little bit more about Callum. This is his scouting report.
The 20-year-old was born on the 11th of November, 1998. Mika Hakkinen had only 10 days earlier won his maiden Formula One driver's title, while Ilott shares the same birthday as actor Leonardo DiCaprio, who was born on the same date, just in 1974. Callum was born in Cambridge in England, famous for its world-renowned University of Cambridge, which was founded in 1209. He had his first drive in a kart just before his 7th birthday and took his competitive novice race license as soon as he was 8. By 12 years old, he'd begun to impress the international karting scene by winning the under-16s Formula Kart Stars British Championship. He also enjoyed off-track success as a member of his school choir, winning the BBC's School Choir of the Year and singing in front of a full house at the Royal Albert Hall. Ilott's debut in single-seater racing at 16 was overseen by Dr. Helmut Marko at Red Bull. He was their first ever driver to be taken straight from karting to F3 in Red Bull livery, competing in the FIA F3 European Championship, during which time he was selected by Ferrari to join its driver development programme, the Ferrari Driver Academy. In 2018, Callum switched to the GP3 series, racing with ART Grand Prix, where he scored two wins and a run of seven podiums in seven consecutive race weekends, finishing third overall in the championship. In July 2017, Callum made his debut in Formula 2 at Silverstone with Trident Racing. He made a full-time switch to the championship for the start of the 2019 season, racing with the Sauber Junior Team by Cheruz. And at 20 years old, Callum had his first taste of driving F1 machinery, testing the C38 for Alfa Romeo Racing at the official test at Circuit de Barcelona, Catalunya in May 2019.
Let's wind it back to the start. Tell me about your family and your childhood.
Starting it back from when I was a young one. First memories, when I was 7 years old, I had a go-karting party at Rye House with a couple other friends. Really enjoyed it. Bugged my dad to go again. Went again maybe a couple more times. And then I think after a while he decided for Christmas he'd get me a go-kart. And then went from there every Wednesday night driving. After school to weekends, once a month, twice a month, three times a month, and now I'm here. So other than that, my childhood consisted of school and racing, really.
So tell me the memories of sitting in that go-kart when you knew that it was going to get serious. What was the emotion?
I didn't really. To be fair, when I started karting, probably the first 2 years, it was just fun, enjoyable. And I think as a kid, you don't really get a lot of experiences where you get a feeling like driving. I mean, I think compared to the normal school sports like rugby, football, I played cricket as well, it's a bit more exciting and a bit different, and especially to what the others were doing. So for me, it was literally just doing that, really enjoying it and experiencing it like that. And then I think it was as soon as I moved internationally, probably age 11, started to race a bit in Europe and that. And actually, I moved up a category and I just clicked with that go-kart. And from there, the results came in and I had a really strong karting career for the next 4 years. I was picked up by Red Bull to go into Formula 3. 3 years of Formula 3, actually, the first year we split at the end of the year with Red Bull. And then the last year of Formula 3 picked up by Ferrari Driver Academy. And now GP3 last year and F2 this year.
So that's the journey all the way through. But it's a pretty drastic step, isn't it, to move to Italy when you're that young, to focus on something that you know is hugely competitive.
To be fair, I was 18 when I moved to Italy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it is, compared to any normal child, I'd say it's definitely different. But I've sort of always been around an environment that's older than me. You know, when you're karting, you're sort of chauffeured around by people who are at least 24, 25. So I've always been in, say, a more mature area than normal. But yeah, Italy was a commitment. Obviously, going there, it's not just a country. It's a country that also you don't speak the language of, so you've got to get to grips with it like that. And I'm not the fastest language learner in the world, so that's taking its time. And at first, it was a bit, I don't know if I say daunting, but, you know, difficult. And you're quite isolated in a sense. But now I'm really, really comfortable and really enjoying it. Especially the summer there this year has been really nice. So.
Speaking of Italy, you are part, as you mentioned, of the Ferrari Driver Academy.
Indeed.
Wearing the prancing horse on your shirt today. Just give everyone an idea of what it's like to be part of a Driver Academy. Because there are a lot of people in Formula 2 who are associated with that. What does that actually mean day to day?
So, first things first, like we said, I live in Italy. You are surrounded in an environment of people who are dedicated to the sport that you're in. So obviously there's another seven members of the Driver Academy, I think. At least one or two are there when I'm there as well. So, you know, people are coming in and out. I'm in and out. Go back to England a couple times. So when you're there in the gym training, physical and mental training, obviously there are some other activities that go along with it. On other days, like I'll head off to Dallara, which is an hour away, to do the simulator for F2 and little extra things. So you're just surrounding yourself in an environment of professionalism, basically. It's not as intense as it sounds, but every day you are doing something. But I live with Marcus Armstrong from Formula 3. So we live together in a house right next to Fiorano. So I spend a lot of time with them. So it is enjoyable as well. But yeah, obviously you're there to do a job as well.
So this is your rookie season in Formula 2.
Yep, minus one race.
Minus the one race. I remember speaking to you on the driver's parade and then you getting a tough start.
Yeah,
what I remember of your debut.
So in quali, on my push lap, halfway through my push lap, the rear wing broke and I managed to bring it home and still improve the time. So I think we were on for a top eight quali in my first ever quali in F2.
Would have been impressive.
Which would have been really impressive. And then in the feature race, so I was starting like P15, I think I had Alex Albon in front of me. And bear in mind, he won last year. had him in front of me, and he stalled it on the formation lap. Oh, and obviously, I'm not used to the hand clutches because I'm driving the old F3.
Yep.
So I tried to go around him, and it's quite a sensitive clutch, and I stalled it as well.
So we talked about your debut in Formula 2, and we are in your full rookie season now. How do you feel it's going?
Good and bad. Yep. I think, no, I don't want to put emphasis on the bad or anything. It's just, it's been a tough season to start off with, but I think the rate of improvement that I've had and we've had as a team from where we started off in Bahrain and Baku, I think it's pretty impressive. We came to Barcelona and I got my first podium, and actually the pace really wasn't bad at all. And Monaco was on the front row, and then we had an issue that was completely out of our control. So real shame, but you know, Monaco, that was pretty much a guaranteed feature race podium and something that I would have taken down in sort of my history, which was, would have been a really good job. So in my eyes, I sort of came away from Monaco with a podium, but I didn't, if in, yep. in a way. And Red Bull Ring was, well, Paul Ricard, I made that mistake coming back through. We had a bad pit stop and I lost, it wasn't on TV, but I lost three positions in the pit stop.
Yeah.
So I had to come back through, and as I was overtaking Matsushita, just lost it. I mean, these things happen, it's a shame, but when I was in a good position, but yeah, what can I do now except learn from it? And then Red Bull Ring, I just overpushed with the tyres, standard F2 style, and dropped off at the end. But basically, I had to take a big look at that and see what I needed to improve with those tyres, because obviously it's one of the most important things in F2 that you have to master. And I think it was good that I messed it up so badly that I had to look at it so closely.
So I want to pick you up on a couple of things there. Yep. What were your expectations coming into this year?
Obviously, to do the best job possible, to learn. I mean, I was hoping for like a feature race podium already, which, to be honest, I should have had in Monaco. The whole goal was to do a good job and be consistent. I haven't been consistent, so I'm a bit annoyed with that, but it's not all down to me, and it's not all down to the team either, so it was something that we couldn't control. But no, I mean, the expectations ideally are to be in top five of the championship, which actually right now wouldn't have been too difficult without a few of the things. So yeah, I would have been in a better position, but I can't complain. I've learned a lot more making the mistakes that I've had,
yeah,
than if I didn't make them. So it's always a shame, because you always want to be right at the top and do the best you can, but sometimes you have to look at everything from the positives.
You know, it makes a lot of sense. It does. I want to go back 1 year to the final year of GP3, when you were with ART, the team that had been dominant there.
Yeah.
You were a race winner last year. You're a race winner fairly early on last year as well, so you're into contention. Do you feel that maybe you got left behind a little bit in all of that?
It was a weird situation. Like, the pace was good first half of the year, and we struggled the last half of the year. Like, we were polling it and stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I think we got to Monza and were disqualified for something on the race two, and then came to Sochi and the tyres dropped off on the second lap. And basically from there, I was out of championship contention. But up until that, it was all trading
places.
You
were in the mix. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got left out in the last phases, but it wasn't, in my eyes, sort of, those things were out of my control.
Yeah.
And I did a really consistent job. I had a podium every race weekend up until Sochi.
Yeah.
And just in the points every single race. So I did a very good job. And the one thing I wanted to work on from F3 days was the consistency of, and I was in the points every single race and had a podium every race weekend. So I worked on that, but for some reason, my natural speed that I've always had wasn't there.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've always struck me as a driver who's got a lot of pace. Is the emphasis now delivering some solid results like you did last year, getting wins on the board and saying, I'm not just quick? Because in Le Castellet,
yeah.
I don't know if you were fuming over the pit stop, but you were circulating so quickly after that stop. I was looking at the gap between you and the guys at the very top, because I was like, well, there's always someone who bolts through the field on a race like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, here comes Callum, and then you had the error.
I think the thing I've got to understand is what I can do on what tyre, because Paul Ricard was on the hard tyre, and actually I had no problem with pace. Obviously, I didn't get to finish the first race, but the team were like a bit worried that I would have killed the tyres. But race two, I did the same thing and pushed, and I didn't have a problem with the tyres. So we were looking at it and like, okay, hard tyres I work well with.
Right.
So that's something I've taken away and learned, and that I've got to adapt the style that I do depending on the tyre. But yeah, the speed was there. I was trying to make up for lost time And my philosophy was a bit more, see how much I can push and then sacrifice at the end when it comes, instead of holding back, because I'm not used to this whole holding back a little bit to be stronger at the end.
Yeah.
It's a weird philosophy to
get into.
Goes
against your instincts.
Yeah, but I've got to change my instincts a little bit somehow as well. But no, the speed's there. I mean, Monaco is clear. Like, when you go to a raw circuit, I'd never been to Monaco before, and I put it on the front row.
Yeah.
I think that shows a little bit something that I can drive a car fast sometimes.
Well, Callum Ilott, thank you very much for speaking about what was a very difficult couple of weeks for you. We wish you well for the rest of the season.
Thank you very much.